it probably is better to keep it in the order, not because I think that Dante in any way understood this to be a progressive thing, except that it is chronologically in the history of the soul. But certainly, as I think I've mentioned a couple times before, the only way that you understand either the Inferno or the Purgatory books is from the vision of heaven that Dante had. I mean, there'd be no point. Why would he want to go through all that if he didn't have something ahead of him that was so compelling that gave him a purpose and a motivation for it? So, although it might be easier to compare heaven at once and to talk about heaven at once and contrast it with hell, I think we'll just take a little time in the purgatory, although we won't spend as much time on it because I don't know how many of you have copies of it, and you may not have time to read it, but I think you should know something about what is in it, and I'll read some of the passages from it just to give you a little idea of what of the kind of place it is, and that it is not the kind of place that most of us think about. When we think about purgatory in the way it's always pictured to us, it's always the next thing to hell. Well, it is the next thing to hell, but the first thing you notice when you read the purgatory is that you are no longer in a place of hard, rocky, unproductive areas. It's not the iron shell of hell that you're in. All of a sudden there's a sky, there's stars, and there is a sense of air. There's something blowing through that's fresh. It's not tainted and stenchful. It's a real switch. In other words, purgatory is not a suburb of hell. It's definitely a milestone or or you are en route to heaven. In other words, it's the direction is toward heaven. There's no way that you can feel that purgatory is a closed off place. I suppose I didn't bring the book. We have the purgatory. It's got the picture of it's got the picture of the mountain of purgatory, and as they're walking around this, Virgil and Dante, the kinds of conversation, the kinds of impressions that you get are at once a foretaste of heaven. The one prominent characteristic of hell is the lack of communication between the circles of hell, but also between the individuals in hell. If they have any communication, it's not communication, it's just statements or vitriolic kinds of shrieks against somebody or other, or defenses. There is a communication when Dante addresses them directly with a question, and then they explain something. But it's always with a bitterness that does not allow for any kind of openness, so that what the other person says is going to change the soul in hell. It's going to change its mind. It won't. It's just a closed statement. All right, you want to know what happened? I'll tell you. And whether it's told in the soft, self-complaining voice of Francesca, or the bitterness of Ugolino, or Chiacco, or any of those people that are just getting it out and spitting it out as fast as they can, they're all closed off. They're all making excuses for themselves, and they don't want to hear what Dante has to say. Anything he would say would simply be interpreted without any communication. That is, there's no understanding of the other person. As soon as you get into purgatory, there is a conversation going on. And this is so different from the whole psychology of hell. And if you stop to think of it, this is something that is a primary factor in the way in which Dante interpreted sin and hell, sin and punishment and hell. It's the isolation of the individual's will carried out into eternity, so that you do exactly what you wanted to do permanently. And the flying moment, so to speak, is captured for you because you don't want it to be, you don't want it to have thought about what its implications are. You only want to live for that moment. And that's exactly what you do in Dante's Hell. You live for that moment, as we talked about in great length with Francesca. She and Paolo live for that one moment, and that's as far as it goes, and that is permanent. And so all she has to talk about is excuses and recriminatory remarks and a complete sense of martyrdom on her part. So she has nothing but misery. And this is what hell is all the way through. No matter what sin it is being personified for you, all of them are sins that were chosen to be lived in. And of course nobody thinks that they're going to be lived in permanently. At the time you think, this is great. This is, oh, I'd like to have this forever. And whether it's, you know, a lot of gemütlichkeit and good company, or whether it's a romance, or whether it's power, or whatever. You want it permanently. All right, you get it. And that's what hell is. You get what you want. It's not that you get what you deserve. You get what you will to have. And this is absolutely important for an understanding that God does not visit you with a punishment. There. You get punished for that. You get punished for that. It's more like if you eat a lot of stuff that you really love it. Oh, do you like it? And you get a violent stomach ache afterwards. Okay, the punishment fits the crime. I mean, you know, you knew what you were doing. I mean, that is not in terms of you didn't actually remember that you were going to have a stomach ache because you'd had it before, but you thought, I will. I just love this. You know? So then you eat it, and you get a violent stomach ache. All right. You do what you want to do, well, you get what comes afterwards. And it's not really a case of deserving in terms of, well, I decided that you deserve this because that's the way I justly figure it out. You know, that I'm the judge and I decide what punishment goes to this person and what punishment goes to this person. No, in Dante's hell and in his whole understanding of punishment, it's what you choose in terms of your sinning, that kind of sin stays with you then in eternity. It's the kind of sin that dominates your life, whatever it happens to be. Of course, it doesn't mean that none of these people in the inferno ever did anything else sinful except the one thing that they're left with. But it's the type of sin or the sin that actually caught them the most and really locked them in to their own wills. Now the purgatory is difficult for us to understand because purgatory is not in the Protestant thinking or imagination. We don't think about purgatory. That's something that the Catholics deal with, but we don't. Well, now the way in which Dante dramatizes it and describes it, although it does seem it's an impossible thing for us to really identify with, still there is a kind of rationale for it if you've been able to live into the medieval imagery of Florence and its transference into hell, as these people from Florence and Italy were all part of Dante's compatriots. If you've been able to live through that, then you can go into the purgatory without too great a jolt, because you see, imaginatively, you've been able to make the leap over the centuries and over the mindsets of our so-called advanced 20th century and moved into the medieval imagery of Dante. Now, the interesting thing is that Dante's theology is a lot more solid than most of ours. I mean, we've got the idea that God is a sleepy cosmic grandfather. I don't care how much you talk about how holy and strong and vigorous, but inside of us, we we kind of cozy up to him and he'll understand, you know, because he's gospel. You know. Well, we don't understand the gospel in terms of the cross and what it all signifies for us and how it moves into us. And so we sort of act as if the gospel was something that was, you know, just easy come, easy go, nothing to it, you know. Well, now, of course, you don't take it that lightly. But down inside of us, we look at Dante and say, oh, couldn't believe a God like that, could you? Well, actually, when you read, if you actually read the Purgatory and read the Paradiso, you would find that the vision of God is a tremendous one. And so far outdistances our thinking or our imagination of it, that it would do us a lot of good to spend a little time on it, simply because it extends our very limited functional brains, because we spend so much of our time with the kind of images that we have in the 20th century. It's really good for you to get into the Middle Ages and get in the someplace where people were not dependent on a on what we saw last night with the commercial TV, you know, and you really do have to, you know, help us, good Lord, when you go through that kind of thing. Well, we're going to just look a little bit at the Purgatory, because I know that most of you haven't probably read it, and you may not have a copy of it, but I do want to read a couple things from it so that you know what it's about. One of the interesting things about the Purgatory is that there is, just as there is in the Inferno, well, there's a vestibule in the Inferno. You remember that, where these people were, this kind of little area that people had to hang around there because they couldn't make up their minds, you know, whether they should live for God or live for themselves, and so they were just in kind of a limbo out there. Well, there's also a little anti-purgatory. There's a little place just outside of purgatory. People aren't allowed to get into purgatory, those people, because they waited for their repentance until so late that they even have to wait before they can be purged and be moved into the purgatory mountain, because they sometimes have to wait 20 years, 30 years. Sometimes they have to wait as long as they lived, as many years as they lived, because they delayed so long in deciding to repent. The scripture that is kind of interesting at the beginning. I think one thing too I was going to mention in terms of the will and why people are in hell. Do you remember in the Inferno how people rushed to get in the boat to cross over to the other side? There was a real press of the crowd. And you thought, they're in such a hurry to get there. Well, because that's what they wanted to do. You see, by the time they got to that point, there was no other choice. There was no other vision. There was nothing else to look for. So they just moved as fast as they could into hell. Now, you know, we very often like to think that God is the one that decides on us. And, you know, well, he's the one that just arbitrarily sits up there and just pushes one group of people to hell and then the other people go to heaven. But it's not that way. And you know, after all, if we have intelligences, don't you think God does? You know, can you really believe that God would sit up there and make that kind of decisions? Of course you don't. I mean, you're not in that kind of a bind, I'm sure. But there are times when you have to discuss this with people, because a lot of people have that concept of God. And this is where the Inferno really helps you. Not that you can quote Dante to them, because they would just gulp and say, yeah, well, that's what you are. You're still living in the Middle Ages. But if you can get into your heads the psychology of Dante, you could do a lot of good strategic witnessing, simply because of the fact that in Dante, the will is always what determines the factor of choice and where you're going to go as far as your life is concerned on this earth or in the future. And this is so clearly portrayed in the Inferno that it's what people wanted to do And when you get to that point, you see, you've got such blinders on that you can't see any of the sun's light that comes from heaven. All you can see is a sort of a driving towards this terrible fascination of hell. And you remember even Dante, on one of the bulges, or the, I forget where he was down on one of the ledges down there, and he was almost fascinated by the horror of hell. It almost drew him in. Well, I mean, this is how really frightful hell is in Dante's picture. And what we, you know, it's not the physical side of it. The physical side is one thing. That's an image. And sometimes it's the only one we can understand. But it's a totality of the whole being just wrapped around this kind of horror that is without God. And so the purgatory comes out of that. And one reason I thought we should talk about the purgatory right away is that maybe one reason the purgatory looks so good is that after hell, it's like a breath of fresh air, even if it's still, you're not in heaven yet. But it's a whole different ball game, so to speak. It's a real movement upwards instead of a movement downwards. You see, the two images are so great next to each other because, you know, hell is like a funnel pulling you down, 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 and they keep going around and around and around. And at the very bottom, of course, is the devil himself, like a great, you know, in the ice down there. And what is purgatory? Purgatory is a mountain that you're going around and around, and the spiral is upward because of the fact that heaven, if you're going to have it dimensional, is usually thought of as being above and hell below, and earth is in the middle. Somebody said, well, you know, it isn't so strange that we really don't know what's down below us. We know a lot more about space than we do about what's underneath us. I forget how many miles we've really been able to go down below the Earth's surface, but it's relatively little compared with what spaceships have done. Well, it behooves us to be a little careful, I think, with what we're standing on, that we don't rock the boat too much. But I want to read one bit from the first canto in Purgatory, because of the coloring of the air and the words that Dante uses. They really live. Sweet color, the translucent tint and tone of orient sapphire, gathering high in heaven, serene and pure down to the primal zone, made using of my eyes a joy re-given, once I had issued forth from the dead air against whose gloom my eyes and breast had striven. The radiant planet, love's own comforter, was setting all a laugh the eastern sky, veiling the fishes that escorted her. I turned to the right and bent my mind thereby on the other pole and saw four stars, the same as, save the first folk, none did e'er espy. The first stars that were in the sky when Adam and Eve were born, supposedly. And he sees them. Joyous seemed heaven of their twinkling flame. O widowed northern clime, bereft indeed, in that thou mayest no longer gaze at them. And then he talks about these, the fact that he can see the stars. And, you know, do you realize that he didn't see any of this in hell? There wasn't a star. There wasn't a light. There was nothing but this dank darkness that was pulling him down. And then he goes along through purgatory. And what you understand from the whole way in which he develops it, you realize that these people in purgatory are not feeling punished in terms of bitterness. They have voluntarily entered into this. And when you are willing to be punished, it takes a lot of the nastiness out of it. It no longer seems to be punishment to you. It seems more like, well, I needed this in order to, I need this in order to really, you know, kind of clear myself up in my head about it. Dorothy Sayers uses the example of somebody who, well, suppose you, of course it would be a teapot since it's English, since she's English. She says, supposing you broke somebody's teapot, you know, you were visiting and she was gone and you broke her teapot. And she came back and here were the teapot fragments all over and you're caught in the act. And what do you do? Well, she's a good friend of yours. You know, she's not going to say, what did you do? You know, she'll say, well, things like that can happen. I realize that. That's all right. We'll get along without it. She'll forgive you. She's not going to visit judgment on you and punishment on you. But, you know, the very fact that she is willing to forgive you that and isn't, you know, beating you or something or won't talk to you for a week or something, makes you feel like you're really going to go and find another teapot. And you're going to find a really nice one because you want something that will somehow, not because it's going to do, you know, be so great that you're going to feel like, well, but because you love that person that was so open in forgiving you, and somehow you want to make some kind of restitution for what you've done, although it won't be the same teapot. You know, it's not going to be as good or as beautiful or as wonderful, but it's going to be something that, as far as you're able to do for her, you will. And something happens to you in the process. Now, says Dorothy Sayers, this is what happens to the people in purgatory. They have gone through the initial entrance into purgatory and are willing to take the time to be cleared of whatever it was that was their dominating sin. And she says it isn't that this is something God is going to be satisfied with and say, well, now you're ready. But at the end of purgatory, when the soul comes who has gone through these different cornices and gradually moved up through all these different things, when he gets to the entrance to heaven, the whole mountain shakes for joy. And the person doesn't go into heaven because somebody says, see, checks out, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yes, you've done this, you've done this, you've done this. Well, okay. And so many people prayed for you, so you're out of this and this and this. I mean, it isn't that kind of a bookkeeping thing. It's something that is happening to the person, to the soul, as he goes through this. And he knows when he's ready. He's clear. He all suddenly feels that his will is now one and ready for heaven. See, that's an entirely different thing from a meted out kind of a thing that is, you know, kind of a bookkeeper, kind of a bank book deposit and withdrawal, checks and balances. It's not that at all. It's something that happens to you. And it happens to you as you're going through this. Now, this is important to understand if you're going to understand medieval theology. Not all Roman Catholic theology was of this nature. But this was an old purgatory idea as it got farther on and they felt that they needed more money in the coffers of the Vatican and the Papal See and so on. They made purgatory more frightening and so that people would put more money in and have more indulgences, and that was kind of built up. But the real purgatory psychology that Dante uses, at least, is one of a purgation of the soul, a cleaning of the soul, a sort of a growth of the soul, so that he gets ready for heaven. Now, we don't believe that, because we believe that Christ died for us while we were yet sinners, and that we are also restored to him, and that we don't have to go through a purgation period. But this is simply something that there's really no real basis in Scripture for any of this.
Yeah.
The only thing that you've got in Scripture that might indicate a period of time is that they did baptize for the dead occasionally, and that was talked about by Paul in a couple of places, I think in Thessalonians and 1 Corinthians. But it doesn't give you any kind of ground for building purgatory. But you've got to remember, you're also reading the story of a soul not only going from hell to heaven, to purgatory to heaven, as Dante says here, but this can also take place in a certain sense in us, although we don't know it sometimes, on earth. as the work of Christ and the Holy Spirit works on you, you don't know that you're going through what would amount to a purgatory. Thank goodness you don't. Otherwise, you'd start looking at yourself and pinching yourself and wondering, how far am I gone today? I mean, how much better am I today? And how many virtues and sins have I evened off or balanced? But the thing is that there is very often, and the thing, it's something that neither you nor sometimes people close to you can ever notice. But somebody other than you might notice, well, you know, that person has really changed. If you feel that you've improved a lot, you may have changed your direction, but you certainly don't feel that you've improved. But other people can say you've improved. But don't be caught with the feeling that, well, thank goodness I don't have that sin anymore. I mean, you know, that sure as anything, you're going to get caught in it again. Or a worse one, which is the sin of Phariseeism. So that's just by the boards, but just to remind you that purgatory isn't that something that you can't also apply a little bit to yourself occasionally from this
Well, in The Great Divorce, Lewis hinted at purgatory too.
Mm-hmm. From shadows to the
spirit.
To these bodies of the resurrected bodies. But you know, you have to remember that images are images, and whatever they are, they are things to make you more aware of the radicality of the Christian faith. You don't have to dwell on the image. You dwell on the fact that this business of being Christian is a radical thing, and it's a life and death matter. And this is what Dante really poses here for you in the terms of a lot of images, and you can get lost in the images. But I think that I wanted to read another little bit here because this is another part where you see that purgatory has a physical surrounding that is beautiful and is natural. You once again are looking out at a created world. Virgil, you see, is still with Dante, and it's interesting that Virgil is allowed to stay to go in purgatory. He really here is just a helpful person with Dante, but he doesn't know much about purgatory because he isn't a Christian. He was very, you know, he could take care of Dante in hell because he'd been born long before, not long before, but before the Christian faith had even begun. But when he comes into purgatory, he's a stranger too, but he is a helper to Dante, and he is able to explain some things and give him some encouragement. And he began, "Follow me close, my son, let us turn back, for this way steadily down doth the plain to its low limits run." The matin hour had now begun to flee before the advancing dawn, and far away I recognized the shimmering of the sea. We paced the lonely level like as they who the road lost go seeking it anew, and till they find it, deem they vainly stray. Have you ever been on a hike and you've lost your, you've gone off the path, which of course you're not supposed to do, you know, but you do, and then you start going around and around and you go in circles and you feel like, you know, where are we? And this is the way they felt. As soon as we had come to where the dew fought with the sun, since it but slowly there evaporated, where a cool air blew, both of his hands outspread with gentle care on the fresh herbage did my master place, whence I, of his contrivance well aware, held up to him my tear-bedrabbled face. Unto my cheeks did he thus quite restore that color of which hell had left no trace. It was almost as if he had a baptism. You see, the Virgil took the dew of the grass of purgatory and wiped the face of Dante, who had been weeping over the tragedy of hell and how awful it was, and had taken all the color out of his face. And Virgil wipes it, washes it with the dew of which has the gospel in it, and grace. And because it has that, it restores the color of health to Dante's face again. It's kind of a, you know, kind of an interesting way that he put it. But now that by now the sun was touching with his flame the horizon, whose meridian, where its height is greatest, overhangs Jerusalem. And circling o'er against him issued night from Ganges, scales in hand, the scales she would let fall, what time she gains on him in might. So that, as seen from there where I then stood, the fair Aurora's cheeks, and Aurora, you know, was the goddess of dawn, all white and red, through excess of age were growing orange-hued, we by the margin of the sea yet stayed like folk who, while they rode they ponder o'er, linger in body, in heart, have onward sped. It's just as if you stand someplace and you're saying goodbye to a certain, maybe to people or to some place, but you've already moved farther ahead. You're thinking about where you're going. And this is what Virgil and Dante were doing. They're thinking about moving on into the area of the purgatory that's going to finally lead them up to God. I think there's one section that I wanted to read to you because it's the question of why did God do this in the first place? I mean, this is a lot of suffering and misery for man. Why would God do that? And in the eighth canto of the Purgatory, you have a pretty strict statement of how Dante explains it. He's asking why the primal why did this all happen? To Virgil this, and the other turned his face to one there seated, and up, Conrad, come and see, he cried, this marvel of God's grace. Then to me turning, by that untold sum of thanks thou owest to him whose primal ground lies at a depth no mortal man mind can plumb. By that untold sum of thanks thou owest to him whose primal ground lies at a depth no mortal mind can plumb. Now, you know what it means to plumb a depth? You know what a plumbing a depth? That means you go down and try to find what's at the bottom of something. That's the word we use, plumb. A plumb line is one that hangs down straight. And when you plumb a depth, you better know what plumbing a depth is. It isn't just plumbers for toilets, but you plumb a depth. That means you go to the bottom of something to try to get at what's down at the very depth of it. When you really ask the question, why God and why me in that relationship, you're asking for something that plumbs a depth. And if you've never asked that question, I'm surprised. But maybe you haven't. Maybe you've never had to ask that question. But I think any adult person has to sometime ask the question, why God and why me? Because if you don't ask that question, why are you ever going to be concerned about answers? You know? Why are you going to be seeking anything of God if you've never asked the question why of him? But what Dante says isn't much help. Because he says that the primal ground, that is the origin of God, lies at such depth that no mortal mind can plumb it. No mortal mind can find the answer to that primal why. Well, you say, why ask a question if you're never going to get an answer? That isn't why you ask a question, is it? You don't ask a question because you know that there's going to be an answer. You ask a question because, just like people climb mountains, why do they climb mountains? Ask any mountain climber, because it's there. Well, you know, you ask a question because the question comes not because you know that there's an answer, like in the catechism. It isn't something that you memorize because here's the question and here's the answer. I have to learn both of them. I've never had the question, of course, but I'll always learn the answer. This is what a running battle I have with the catechism. Because I love the catechism, Luther's catechism, but I do feel that very often we put questions to people when they've never even asked the question. So then they've got a whole lot of answers that mean nothing, zero to them. But the question will come to any thinking person, and hopefully you are that and will be that. And people with curiosity and wonderment. And when you are, you're going to ask this question that has to do with the primal why, the original why. And the original why is rooted in God. And so then your questioning is going to be eventually finding its answers in a number of different ways. And this is what the purgatory is about, what the inferno is about, and what the paradise is about, is the answer to this question of why God, why me? Well, I want to read just one. No, I don't. My clock is now 11:05. Is that about right? Does anybody know?
5 after.
Okay. I want to get into the paradise before too late. I'm going to. I want to just read this one place where in the paradise, purgatory. The description of this shout of joy when the soul goes up. It's really, I think, kind of a fun one. The thing about all of Dante is that if you remember that his images are always things that have to do with natural phenomena. He's always referring to something that he's experienced. He'll have one place where the farmer is, even in hell, you know, where he looks down and sees all these twinkling lights in one place, and those lights are mean something really bad. But for a moment, he uses as the image the evening and the twilight of the farm country, and how the twinkling lights of all the little fires of the houses, the farmhouses, and the places around, and for a moment you get a feeling of lightness, even in the midst of death and destruction, which hell is. Well, here he in the canto in Purgatory. He's just talked about an earthquake, and how the earthquake in hell, for instance, when Christ went down. You know, we talk about the descent into hell and the harrowing of hell when Christ goes down and in the inferno he does. Dante explains that Christ did talk to some of the people and brought them back to so that they were able to come back out of hell. Because Christ went down and preached to the saints in hell, but also in hell there's some of the ridges, both in all through the era, the physical aspects of hell have been caused by great earthquakes, and then he uses the earthquake as an example of something that I'm going to read here. It quakes here, that is the earth, it quakes here every time that a soul feels itself clean and is therefore moved to ascend or rises. Then this shout, to speed it, peals. Of cleanness, proof is from the will obtained alone, by which, all free to change its mates, the soul is seized and in volition sustained. True, it wills to rise before, but the impulse lets it not, which divine justice against the will, as 'twas to sinning, to the torment sets. And when the man tells Virgil this, tells Dante this, he's really explaining that what I told you about before, that the whole process of movement from a will that's negative and locked into hell, it's an entirely different kind of will. It's a will that's moving toward God rather than toward toward self. It doesn't mean that the will itself is gradually getting better in itself. The will has been caught by the gospel, has been caught by God to move upwards, but it takes a while to get it cleared of all the stuff. It's this teapot business again, to get cleared of all the stuff that's been hanging on to it, and so that it's ready for heaven. Now, as I say, just remember, this is the story of purgatory, the image of purgatory, and you don't have to, you know, swallow it whole, but some of the images in it are beautiful and worth reading, because they do have a certain quality that is applicable even to those of us who are Protestant and without that kind of even the vaguest kind of relationship with it. I think I should read to you too a little bit more from one thing from the cornice of fire in the purgatory, because it contrasts so with the Francesca and Paolo episode in the Inferno. The way in which the people who have been caught in this romanticism and this romantic concept of love as being something permanent for themselves. And in I think it's in 26. You remember how Francesca talks in the Inferno, how she's excusing herself and making statements about the fact that other people, it was all the fault of other people, and it was the fault of the author of the book, and after all, you know, they sent this beautiful young lad over, and and then she spits out this business about the people that the person who murdered her and her lover are to be, you know, they're in the same place as Cain, the murderer Cain. And so you get a feeling of just, you know, what the people in hell never learn anything. You know, they never improve, they never change, they only get worse, which is really, you know, a tragic situation to be in. well, in the Inferno, it's Canto 5. Does anybody have the Inferno with them? Look in Canto 5 and, 88 and following to 95, and then skips a little bit, and then there's some more after that. I'll read this. Who's got it? Gretchen, do you have that? Do you have Canto 5 there? The Inferno? Line 88, from 88 to 95. You want to read that out loud?
O living creature, gracious and so kind, coming through this black air to visit us who in death the globe incarnadined.
Mm-hmm. Incarnadined, I suppose, to rhyme with kind.
Okay. Were the world's king our friend, and might we thus entreat, we would entreat him for thy peace, that piteous so our pangs dispiteous.
Mm-hmm.
Hear all thou wilt, and speak as thou shalt please, and we will gladly speak to thee and hear, while the winds cease to howl as they now cease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, then down a little bit farther, where she starts telling about what happened to her. Is that in...
121?
Yeah, about that. Yeah. I've got it here. I could look at it myself.
The bitterest rule of woes, to remember in our wretchedness old happy times, and this thy doctor knows. Yet so, if so dear desire thy heart possess to know all that root of love which wrought our fall, I'll be as those who weep and those confess, and who confess. One day we read for pastime how enthralled Lord Lancelot lay to love, who loved the queen. We were alone, we thought no harm at all. As we read on, our eyes met now and then, and to our cheeks the changing color started. But just one moment overcame us when we read of the smile, desired of lips long thwarted, such smile, by such a lover kissed away. He that may never more from me be parted, trembling all over, kissed my mouth. I said, the book was Galliot.
Mm-hmm.
Galliot, the complying ribald,
mm-hmm.
who wrote, we read no more that day. Well, the one spirit thus spoke, the other's crying wailed on me with a sound so lamentable. Was that right?
Yeah, that's right.
I swooned for pity like I was like I were dying, and as a dead man falling, down I fell.
Cool. Now that's the story of Francesca, you know, and that's the way Dante feels about it. He's really gripped by this tragedy. Now in the in the seventh cornice, you know, the cornices are these little places around the mountain of purgatory. There's another, the people who are who had committed sins of passion in romance that were wrong, but they repented of them. They didn't make excuses, and they repented and were forgiven, but they had to go through some kind of, you know, cleansing period. And so in the seventh cornice you have the cornice of fire that is for lovers who need to be cleaned of their fire. And it doesn't mean that Dante in any way thought that it was wrong to love passionately or that physical love was bad or anything like that, but that these things were made permanent, and that they had something to do with a wrong relationship. This is what was wrong about them. And that, as we talked about last time, the person or person was not willing to take the responsibility of making that love a part of God's glory. And if you did that, then it couldn't be painted by a wrong relationship in the first place. If it's going to be under the purity of God, it would have to be cleared up. And so the people that are in the purgatory fire, cornice of fire, and are on their way to heaven are people who have repented of this, who have reflected on what they've done, and instead of blaming everybody else as Francesca is doing, still blaming, still holding on to her position that she was put upon and it wasn't her fault, they say, it was my fault, mea culpa, which is what the old Latin word is, my fault, it's my fault, but it's my happy fault because I realize that since I realized my fault, I also realized the gospel. And so they come to forgiveness. Well, this is what happens in the cornice of fire, and it's not very long, but it's quite a contrast to the way in which Francesca talks. And it's in Canto 26. I got the wrong canto here. The trouble is, when I have two, I've got two sets of notes, and it's not very helpful to go over them again and again and again to be sure that you get them all, you know, down in as tight form as possible, and then you get the wrong you write down the wrong quote. Well, I'll have to look it up again because I tried to use this one volume so because it has all three all the books in it, and I should really carry the ones that I've got all my underlining in because it would be a lot simpler for me, but anyway, the whole understanding that you get from that particular from the quotation in the purgatory is that there is no sense of blaming anyone. There's only a desire to be clear and to be clean and very, very grateful that this person is now on his way toward heaven, rather than a feeling of well, it was all somebody else's fault in the first place. And it's something that I think is basic to all of the both the purgatory and the inferno, is that the contrast between the two is that the people in the purgatory are never blaming other people. They're taking full responsibility for their sin. In hell, nobody takes responsibility for his sin. It's always somebody else that has done it. Now, when you start rationalizing yourself, your positions about things, which I do quite often, and justify yourself and think, well, I had a right to be mad, you know, or somebody did that to me, and I'm, you know, I'm really irked by it, and are driven to something that's really, you know, not under God, not under the gospel. And then afterwards, when you come to yourself, instead of saying, well, you know, it's true, rationally speaking, there was some fault on both sides, but I had more sense. I've lived in the gospel. I ought to know better, you know. And the Lord has to, you know, you just have to forgive me for being such a fool, such a stupid fool, and do something about me, change me, so I don't do it again and again and again. Which of course we do, but fortunately we can come creeping back to our baptism and come back to the gospel again and be forgiven again. But the thing is about when you get into the psychology of hell, you no longer need forgiveness, because why do you have to be forgiven if it's somebody else's fault all the time? You see, you preclude the possibility of the gospel because you've justified yourself, and that's what you live in, self-justification. So the two books are in great contrast to each other in their whole idea span, because one is self-justifying and the other one is taking guilt and being responsible for yourself. This doesn't mean that you are denying the work of salvation or what Christ has done. There would be no way that you'd ever change your point of view if it hadn't been for what Christ did. But what is happening to you psychologically, internally, and eventually externally is that there's a whole change of life, the way you look at things, the way you live, because of the fact that the gospel has come into your life. And that comes in because of the cross and because of Christ's resurrection, and not because of anything that you've done on your own. So you see, it doesn't cut out the cross or the validity of Christ's atonement. What it does do is try to show you what happens to you when the full implication of Christ's work becomes apparent to you. Then all of a sudden you take responsibility as a human being that's adult and free to choose in God rather than out of God, which is what hell is. Now, the interesting thing about the paradise is that the paradise is oh, I see what I did. I knew it. I was in paradise instead of in purgatory. I'm sorry. I was looking for the quote in the wrong book, and I was thinking about that I had the Sears editions, and each edition, each book, you know, is in one book by itself. So I was busy at the 26th canto, you know, and not paying any attention to the fact that this is the Wicksteed translation, which has everything in one volume. Oh, so stupid. Well, you know, the Lord doesn't forgive stupidity all the time either. One thing William says is that heaven is accurate, accurate, accurate. And every time he says that, I think, how am I going to make it? Good thing the Lord covers that too. But, well, I'll find it now. It's because it's not that this section isn't long, but it's just that it's such a good contrast with the Francesca one in the Inferno. And it'll just be a minute, and then we'll go into the paradise and get an idea of what goes on in heaven, and that it isn't just a big old tiresome thing that is something to be borne. All this person says is that Arno Daniel is the name of the person that has been caught in a position of passion and romance. And he doesn't, you know, he says he just wants to know who he is, Dante wants to know, and he without reserve took up his tale. Such is my pleasure in your courteous plea. And Wicksteed has translated this in sort of a kind of a Chaucerian English, because it was a dialect in Italian that Dante used. That I will my name conceal. I am Arno, who weeping, singing, see in mind past folly, and before me plain with joy see my long sought felicity. Now pray you, by that power which not in vain up this high mountain stair hath led you sure, bethink you in due season of my pain. Then hid he in the fire that makes them pure. This is all he says. He was caught in a passion that was wrong, and there's nothing about describing the passion, which Francesca goes into great detail, and of course, which makes for great reading. You know how they parleyed with the whole thing, but not in purgatory. He doesn't think about all that stuff. All he thinks about is the fact that he's sorry for what he did, and all he can think about is what is ahead of him and is the felicity or happiness of heaven, and what he can look toward in terms of the complete vision of heaven when he is a part of it. So you see the concentration of even the number of lines taken with that kind of thing in the purgatory as compared with the amount of time that Francesca used to justify her position in the inferno. It's an entirely different thing. One thing too you notice is that when we start making excuses, you know, our mouths are full of them. You know, you start saying, giving one, and you've got to make a few more. It's just like when you tell one lie, you've got to tell another to cover that one. And pretty soon, you know, you've got a house of lies on top of you. And it's the same way with excuses. But when you're telling the truth, it doesn't take that long. You know, you don't have to spell everything out, because you don't have to embellish it. And you don't have to explain why you did it. I mean, the fact is, you did it. Okay? I'll take it for what it's worth. And this is the great kind of transparent honesty of the people in the purgatory. And I don't have it, but, you know, and I don't plan to go through purgatory, but I'm glad that the Lord will provide us with that kind of honesty, and we get little bits of it once in a while as we allow Him to move in on us. The paradise is dominated by the generosity of God. I think you have to think about God as being love, of course. But you know, we think of love, and love gets to be such a mealy-mouthed word that it's used for everybody and everything. But maybe using generosity, maybe magnanimity, maybe something that has bigness to it would catch us a little bit in our understanding of who and what God is, what He's doing. It's always done, you know, as a great, expanding, eternally wide kind of embrace. And that's hard for human beings who are limited by our finiteness to catch. But it's there. I'm talking about they're getting there. I'm talking about what we're doing when we're there. So they'll want to get there. No, I don't have any. I've already sent it down. It's so well, it worked out so well today. I sent out both my suitcases with Paul down to the dock. I want to read the 30th canto in the paradise, because it's got a lot of wonderful things in it, but I'm just going to read a little bit of it and then read one. Well, there's one part I better read first in case I get another of those radical calls from my husband. Are you coming? This is the 120th in the 30th canto. Well, I'll go before that. There, near and far, nor adds nor takes away. For where immediately God is king, the natural law, being void, suspends its sway. To the yellow of the rose, which blossoming for age spreads tiered petals, wafting praise unto the sun that makes perpetual spring, beateth through me, like to one who says nothing, yet fain would speak. And look, said she, how vast a white stole gathering meets thy gaze. See the vast compass of our city. See our stall so crowded that we need but few fresh comers to complete our company. On that proud throne, impressed upon thy view by the crown poised already on its feet, ere at this marriage thou art feasting too, shall rest the soul, emperor predestinate of the great Harry, who before her day be ripe will come to set Italia straight. Even in the vision of paradise, Dante is a citizen of his country. He loves Italy. He longs for her restoration. She's been caught by so much political fraud and treachery. And I think it's so great that you get the sense that for Dante, it wasn't an otherworldly kind of a religion. There was no kind of a business of being, you know, oh, I've got more important things to do than take care of this world, you know. All through the whole comedy, there is a continual concern for Florence and for Italy. So don't let anybody say to you that Christianity is an otherworldly religion. It isn't. The world that we have to deal with is right here. And that the vision of that world beyond has to color the way we deal with this world that we're in. And it's essential that you get that. But you don't get the idea that Christians just slough it off, you know? Because we don't. We can't. And Dante is not just a literary image of somebody that is avoiding responsibility. He's in exile, for one thing, because he fought against other people within his own city, and he felt that they were wrong. He felt that they were sinning, the other group. That he calls them the heretics in the Inferno. And his whole exile is because they considered him a traitor to his country, and he felt that, and to his city, and they felt that, and he felt that they were. And so you get the sense that here this man is in exile, and he's writing about the life of a person as he goes from a wandering away from God through the a vision of hell and purgatory, and then into a vision of heaven. But he never actually leaves his love, his actual physical love of the land of Italy, his physical concern for the city of Florence. So don't get detached from what's here, because this is all you've got right now, and it's going to have a lot to do with your future. And the thing that heaven is, as Dorothy Sayers or Williams, one of them says, it's all the imagined perfections of everything you can think of, and it's all happening at once, and it's all right now. See, heaven is not a linear thing. It's not a long one, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 millions of eons in terms of time. It's something you can't conceive of. It wraps up experience and everything that is great in an ecstasy of joy and love and light. And we may have to take a few minutes on that when I come back before we take The Descent into Hell of Charles Williams, because I hate to leave you with not enough of the paradise to make you realize that the paradise is so much more than purgatory or hell or anything on earth that is entered into the mind of man. And that's what Dante tries to get through in the paradise, is that it hasn't entered into the mind of man what God has prepared for them that love him. You know, this is something that is very hard for us to grab, because we only think in terms of our human eyesight and our human experience. But this is something that's beyond that. So we will go into just a little bit of that. One word that I think you might be interested in, though, that is part of Dante's own peculiar speech, is a word that he calls in-othering. In-othering. That means when we live into one another, and another person ministers to us, and we minister to another. Not only does this happen, but we have in-godding. God becomes, you know, begins to plant his image into us more and more, and he becomes a part of us. And in a sense, we can become a part of him. In-godding. It's a tremendous image word. But it's true. Because it's actually scriptural.
You know, I'm going to dwell in them even as you and I will come and sup with them. We're going to be part of them, he says. When Jesus talks about in the 17th chapter of John, remember? And this is what the in God is. It's the God in us and the we in God. And it's not some great, you know, glorification of ourselves, but it's something that God does for us when he does it through the incarnation and through his own entrance into our lives. And this also means an in-othering, so that we live in one another.